All right, get ready to dive deep into ancient Israel with us. We're looking at 2 Samuel chapters 4, 5, and 6. Talk about drama. It's like Game of Thrones, but with divine intervention instead of dragons.
Right.
We've got these incredible notes from Dr. Robert Chisholm, a leading expert on this period.
He's great.
We're going to trace David's rise to power. It was a long time coming, years of rivalry with King Saul.
Yeah.
But as you'll see, getting power isn't everything. There's a lot of, well, baggage that comes with it.
Yeah.
And not everyone is exactly thrilled about King David.
These chapters are really important. You see David finally on the throne, but it shows all the tough choices a king has to make and the compromises, too.
It's not all sunshine and roses.
Definitely not.
Okay, so just to set the scene, Saul's dead, right? And his son, Ishbosheth, is ruling the northern tribes.
Yeah.
But he's not exactly a strong leader, is he?
Not really. Not at all, actually. And two of his own guys, Rechab and Baanah, see this as their chance. They decide to assassinate Ishbosheth.
Oh.
They actually thought they'd be heroes if they brought his head to David.
No way. They really thought that would get them on David's good side.
I think they thought they were doing David a favor. You know, getting rid of the competition and paving the way for a unified kingdom.
Makes sense.
But David's reaction, not what they expected at all. He was furious.
Yeah.
Had them executed for harming the Lord's anointed, even though technically Ishbosheth was his rival.
It's interesting because it's like what happened earlier with that Amalekite. Remember, the one who said he killed Saul.
Oh, right.
David had him executed too. So it seems like David's fiercely protective of the throne, even when the king is dead.
It is about the principle, you know.
But then there's Joab.
Ah, Joab. Now that's a whole other story. He was David's general, totally loyal. But he'd already killed Abner.
Saul's top commander.
Exactly. It started a whole chain of events that got us to this point.
And David didn't do anything about it.
Nope. Didn't punish Joab for that murder at all, even though it was totally revenge.
So is David really all about justice? Or is it more about loyalty to his inner circle?
That's the tension in these chapters, isn't it? Like, is there one standard of justice for most people and a different one for those closest to David? It's something to think about, for sure.
It definitely sets us up for some drama later on. Okay, so with Ishbosheth gone, all the Israelite tribes finally unite under David.
About time.
Big coronation ceremony in Hebron. David's 30 years old, and according to prophecy, he's going to rule for 40 years. So he's the king. What's his next move?
Well, first things first, he needs a capital city.
Makes sense.
One that's worthy of a king with big ambitions. And of course, the ultimate prize is Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, held by the Jebusites.
Right. And they were so confident, so sure of their city's defenses. They mocked David. Literally said even blind and lame men could defend the city against him.
Wow.
But how did David's forces get in? It's actually kind of a mystery.
They're a mystery, really.
Yeah. The Hebrew word, sinor, I think that's how you pronounce it. It's used to describe how David's men got into the city, but the meaning is, well, it could be a few things. Some scholars think it's talking about a water shaft that David's men maybe used to sneak in.
Ooh, a secret water passage, like something straight out of an ancient spy movie.
I know, right? But others think sinor might mean a weapon.
Okay.
Or even referring to a really brutal, violent attack, like at the throat.
So we don't know for sure.
Not 100%. It's kind of cool, though. Even David's victories have this element of mystery.
Yeah, it just shows how much we don't know about how they fought wars back then.
I know.
But one way or another, Jerusalem falls, and it becomes David's stronghold, the city of David. He fortifies it, builds a magnificent palace, even gets international recognition.
Yeah, King Hiram of Tyre sends him cedar wood and skilled builders.
Talk about fancy.
David is on top of the world at this point, literally and figuratively. But in Dr. Chisholm's notes, he points out that success often leads to problems.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Especially in David's personal life. He starts taking more wives and concubines. Now, having multiple wives wasn't that unusual for ancient kings, but
hold on, isn't that a problem? Didn't Deuteronomy forbid kings from having too many wives?
You're right. It did.
So what was the reasoning behind that?
It wasn't about jealousy, really. More about focus. The idea was the king should be totally dedicated to God. And having a ton of wives, that could be a huge distraction, lead to bad choices, maybe even pull him away from his faith.
And ironically, that's exactly what happens later with Solomon. All his wives end up leading him astray.
Exactly.
So is this a sign of trouble to come for David?
It's something to think about, right? Is this just David showing off his power? Or is it the beginning of a slippery slope? I like how the source just puts it out there without condemning David outright. Makes you wonder.
So David's king, right? He's got the kingdom. He's building up this incredible capital city. But we can't forget about the other stuff going on, like outside threats.
Yeah.
Weren't the Philistines a constant pain for Saul?
Oh, absolutely. A constant problem. And they definitely saw this whole change in leadership as an opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they could take advantage, get some of their territory back, you know?
Yeah, makes sense. New king, maybe some instability.
Right.
But David, he wasn't Saul. He had a different way of handling things, especially warfare.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He would always consult God before going into battle.
Always. It was crucial for him.
Dr. Chisholm points out that it wasn't just about being religious. It shows a different view of warfare in those days.
Right. Like, it wasn't enough for David to have a good strategy.
Yeah.
He had to know he had God's support.
Interesting.
Had to feel like it was God's will, you know, before he'd actually fight.
So it wasn't just about being the best army.
Nope.
It was about being on God's side. Makes you wonder if their enemies thought the same way.
Good question. It's hard to say for sure what the Philistines believed.
Yeah.
But we know, for David, believing in God's power, that's a big part of why he kept winning.
His faith was his secret weapon.
Maybe, yeah. Dr. Chisholm actually talks about this one battle. Pretty interesting one. God told David to go around the Philistines and wait. Wait for a specific sound. The sound of marching in the tops of the poplar trees.
Wait, marching in trees? What does that even mean?
I know, it sounds strange, right? It doesn't mean the trees were marching.
Okay.
It means the sound of an army marching in the trees. It was the signal that God's army, God's forces, were leading the charge, like a divine air force going ahead and clearing the way for David.
Whoa. So David's victories, they weren't just about military tactics. It was like being on the right side spiritually.
Exactly.
It makes you think how much religion and war were all mixed up back then.
Totally intertwined. But even with God seemingly on his side, David still had problems.
I guess nobody's life is perfect.
One of the biggest issues he ran into involved bringing back the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, yeah. It makes sense, though, right?
Yeah.
Unified kingdom, they need their faith to be unified, too.
Definitely.
Jerusalem's the political capital. Why not make it the religious one, too?
Right, exactly. That was David's thinking. He wanted to bring the Ark,
yeah,
you know, the symbol of God's presence, to Jerusalem from this little town where it had been for who knows how long.
So what happened?
Well, it seemed like a good idea, right? But they made a mistake. A big one.
Oh.
They put the Ark on a new cart. They built a cart to transport it.
Okay. So what's wrong with that? It's a way to move it.
The thing is, there are very specific instructions in the Torah about how you're supposed to move the Ark.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Only the Levites were allowed to carry it.
Yeah.
Using poles. And they couldn't touch the Ark itself.
I have a bad feeling about this.
Yeah. As they're moving the Ark, the oxen pulling the cart, they stumbled. And this guy, Uzzah, he reached out to steady it, like a reflex, you know, just trying to help.
Yeah, a natural reaction. I'm sure he didn't think he was doing anything wrong.
Right. But he touched the Ark. And because of that, God struck him dead right there.
Whoa. So it wasn't just an old rule. God's power was real and very serious business.
You can say that again. David was terrified, like totally freaked out.
Yeah, I bet.
He stopped the whole thing immediately. Didn't bring the Ark to Jerusalem. Left it at this guy Obed-Edom's house for 3 months. Too scared to even go near it.
What happened to Obed-Edom? Did something happen to him too?
Nope. Actually the opposite. God blessed him. And his whole household.
Really?
Yeah. Word got back to David and he realized maybe he should have followed the rules in the first place.
Okay, so round two. What happens when David tries to move the Ark again?
This time she did everything right. Studied up, followed the instructions, had the Levites carry it with the poles, the whole nine yards.
Good.
Big celebration, music, dancing. David was even dancing himself, wearing a linen ephod like a priestly garment. He was really happy, truly rejoicing before God.
Sounds like a great moment, a true celebration.
It was, until Michal, David's wife, saw what was happening. She was not happy, thought he was making a fool of himself.
Oh.
But David's answer to her, amazing. He basically said, I'm not dancing for people, I'm dancing for God.
So he wasn't backing down, not ashamed of his faith, not one bit.
Nope. And Dr. Chisholm points out this really ironic thing. The source mentions that Michal never had any children.
Oh, wow.
Whether it's a David's choice or maybe even God's will, who knows. But it's presented as a consequence of her disrespect.
Interesting. So you've got David dancing joyfully before the Ark and Michal criticizing him. And she ends up childless.
Yeah. It really shows how important it was to respect God's power. Don't question those chosen by God.
You know? Yeah. You definitely don't want to be on the wrong side of that.
Right. And it also reminds us, even though David's achieving all this, uniting the kingdom, making Jerusalem his own, there are still problems, especially with those connected to Saul's family.
Wow. So we've seen a lot. David went from being on the run to king, conquered Jerusalem, even brought back the Ark of the Covenant. That's pretty impressive.
It is. You know, he accomplished some incredible things, but it wasn't always smooth sailing.
True. It seems like there's trouble brewing with his family, yeah, but maybe even with God, too.
Well, I wouldn't say trouble exactly. It's more like, yes, the text is setting the stage for what comes next in David's story.
Okay, so these chapters in 2 Samuel, they're not just about what David did. They're about what, like, the bigger picture.
Right. They introduce these themes that keep popping up. Power, ambition, how important it is to be faithful, the consequences of, well, doing what God wants or not doing what God wants.
So we shouldn't just think of David as a hero.
I wouldn't say that. It's more that he's complex. I mean, he is a brilliant military leader.
Yeah.
And he's definitely a devout person, but he's not perfect. He messes up. And the Bible doesn't try to hide that.
Yeah.
Which is actually what makes his story so interesting, even thousands of years later.
It's like we see ourselves in him, right?
Exactly. We all struggle with temptation, power, family drama. It's part of being human.
Makes you think, would we do any better if we were in his shoes?
Right. Dr. Chisholm really highlights that in his notes. Even the most successful people are still just people.
Makes sense.
They make bad choices, face tough challenges, and they always have to, you know, work at staying true to themselves.
That's a good point, especially when you think about leaders today. I mean, do they see their job as serving others like David did? Or is it more about, I don't know, getting ahead?
It's a question worth asking, for sure. Dr. Chisholm leaves us with that.
Yeah.
It's not just ancient history, what we read in 2 Samuel. It's like a mirror, reflecting things that are still true about human nature, about leadership and faith and all that. What does it mean to be strong but also humble? Where do you draw the line between ambition and serving others? How do you handle power without losing sight of what really matters?
Those are some really deep questions, and it's not just for leaders, right?
It's for everyone.
So as you go about your day, think about that. What can we learn from David, from his good decisions and, well, his not so good decisions? How can we use those lessons, those ancient lessons, in our own lives, no matter who we are or what we do? Until next time, keep on deep diving.